So that's why this perspective actually shows us, at least to many of us, that the first of all, we have a lot of untapped potential in the industry, and second of all, the people in the industry are not happy because of the experience they have at work, which actually affects their well-being. So this is the importance of having this knowledge-centric perspective.
It's time for Scraping Toasts again, a show about organizational effectiveness, great thinkers whose wisdoms we struggle to apply, why things are the way they are, and what you might do about that. My name is Jussi Mäkelä, and in today's episode I get to interview Dimitar Bagarciev. He's widely known and recognized in the community behind the Kanban method since many, many years ago, and was even nominated for the Brickell Key Award for his work in the community. He is a seasoned software development executive and even runs a publishing house to make the writings of people like Dr. Deming and Ellie Goldratt more accessible to people in his home country of Bulgaria. These days, he's working on helping the IT industry to apply a completely different kind of perspective into software development. What he calls the knowledge-centric perspective is a way to understand and discover the invisible aspects that drive productivity, effectiveness, and happiness on individual, team, and organizational level by making them far more concrete and relevant for everyone, regardless of if you're the CEO or an engineer. According to him, these aspects are in fact the primary aspects that hide massive amounts of untapped potential hidden from plain sight. Based on this model he calls the Knowledge Discovery Efficiency, or KDE for short, he has founded a startup offering a system for managers to get a more complete understanding of how well their software organization truly is working and what to do to improve it. So, if that sounds like an important topic to you, I suggest you pay attention to what Dimitar has to say. I really dig his positive and humane message on the topic, so I hope you do too. All right, let's get it. So, all right, let's dive in and talk about everybody's favorite topic, productivity. That's been on the news lately quite a bit. And a few months ago, something you wrote on LinkedIn sort of caught my attention as it stuck out from the typical content in my feed. And I think that post made the point that knowledge is the fuel of software development, and how efficiently you do knowledge discovery sort of determines the how good you are at doing that work of, well, let's say software development in this case. And so that prompted me to do some background research on you and why I contacted you in the first place. And I learned that you were proposing knowledge discovery efficiency as some sort of a measure to understand the productivity of knowledge work and knowledge workers and things like that. So before we go into the details of what you mean by those things, can you quickly describe what kind of productivity we are talking about here? Because nobody seems to define productivity, right?
Right. So importantly, I am not in productivity, right? Because productivity, it is when we measure the output or the outcome relative to some input, right? And what I'm doing, I'm actually measuring the input, not the output, which means that if we take this notion that software development runs on knowledge, that's the input. And we try to measure the input and productivity. It is very much context sensitive thing because you know I'm Ellie Goldratt's publisher in Bulgaria, so the famous author of the theory of constraints, and he has this idea that in order to measure productivity, first you need to define it, and in order to define it, you need to know your goal, what actually you're measuring. So, because you have to measure how close are you to your goal, which means that in different places, the goals might be different. One organization might want to be as fast as possible to, let's say, deliver features as fast as possible. Then they will be measuring probably the number of features per unit time. Another organization might want to make as much money as possible, no matter the number of features. So they might measure the outcome in terms of money, which would then be productivity for them would be money per unit of time, right? And here, what we actually do with the knowledge-centric perspective is that we say, okay, so if your outcome is, let's say, money or number of features, we're interested in the input. So let's define productivity then in terms of outcome relative to the knowledge that was needed to be acquired in order to get the outcome. And this might be the way I would speculate productivity can be measured. But again, I am myself in the inputs. I'm interested in the inputs into the software development process, not that much in the outputs.
So to me, this seems like it's a new perspective in many ways, at least if you consider the typical discussions we have out there in organizations. And was there like a specific moment you can remember when you sort of realized that, oh, this is it? Or what was it that led you into realize that this knowledge discovery thing is actually the thing we need to understand?
Yeah, so I cannot recall a specific moment, but it was, if I have to go backwards, maybe the first time when I looked into it was in 2017, so quite long ago. But it was a very much early thing. And then, I mean, if I, like, historically, I believe it was kind of accumulation of things, right? For instance, I was very much involved with the global Kanban community because I say I was because right now I'm focused on my startup, so I don't have time. But they in the Kanban method, we have this a notion of knowledge discovery process. Okay, so it says that software development more or less is a knowledge discovery process, and we try to manage it as such, right? But this notion stays at the level of quality, or let's put it this way, not thoroughly investigated, okay? And the difference between a knowledge-centric perspective and a let's say a traditional flow perspective is as follows, right? Let's take Scrum or Kanban or any agile methodology. So what they do there is to look at software development as a manufacturing process. So what does this mean? It means that they track tangible things. For instance, user stories, resolution time for a pull request, anything tangible, like some people in the past, they tracked lines of code, for instance, because it's also tangible. So this perspective is valid, but it originated from manufacturing, where they also track lead time, throughput, flow efficiency, working progress, etc., etc. And this is a valid perspective. Again, I am a Kanban guy, and I invested a lot into this. But in software development, in particular, if we assume that software development runs on knowledge, so we would like to track the inputs, what is invisible, intangible, because knowledge is intangible. And this perspective focuses on the intangible, on the invisible parts of software development in particular. Both perspectives, the flow perspective and the knowledge-centric perspective, they don't collide. They complement each other. Because indeed, software development, there is a lot of tangible things happening, right? You have to actually deliver something tangible, like source code, which is tangible thing. So they don't collide, they complement each other. And I believe together they provide a comprehensive view on what is going on in a software development team or organization. So that's the main thing about the new perspective, I guess. Just to probably close this question properly, it's a valid perspective because, let's say, you have a dependency, your team, let's say they have a dependency on another team, right? So this thing, it's physical. I mean, this dependency is there and you should manage it properly. And then you have physical things like, for instance, pull requests. They are physical. They should be managed properly. You can apply the queuing theory, the whole mathematical apparatus of queuing theory, and just to manage these tangible things, right? And this is valid, and it is very valuable, but this is not the crux of the matter, right? Because most of the work in software development, it's the knowledge work. It's not tangible. And there is a very, well, for me at least, quite famous article by Peter Drucker, and it was called, I believe, The Challenge of, Knowledge Worker Productivity, the Biggest Challenge. And it was published end of the previous century. And there he actually considers knowledge work, any type of knowledge work, like not software development only, any type of knowledge work to be kind of consist of two parts. So some kind of a manual work, and then there is some knowledge work. And if we take this approach, and I very much subscribe to this view, then any type of work has a more or less a knowledge component and a manual component. And for instance, in software development, what would be the manual component? It's the typing. Mm. More or less like when you create a pull request, when you resolve a pull request, whatever you do, people usually type stuff. So this is something manual, right? And this is part of the knowledge work, software development in particular. But then the biggest part is the knowledge part, which is invisible. And it comprises things like thinking about a problem, looking for solutions, looking for alternatives, communicating with people about to find out, to better understand the problem, etc., etc., etc. We and all these activities, they by themselves, they don't have tangible trace. They unless you keep your email messages or Slack messages or whatever, there will be no tangible trace, right? And then the whole thing will culminate into some files containing tangible pieces of source code, right? Symbols or lines or whatever. So the both perspectives are valid, and both perspectives should be accounted for. I would say, yeah, but the biggest part is the invisible part, the intangible part. And I believe mostly, like intuitively, most of the people would agree with this, right? Mm.
I don't hear these invisible parts being actively managed at all, so I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case.
Yeah, so let's dig in if we have time, right? So let's say, and it's not about software development only, right? Let's say, so you are based in Sweden, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so and you probably have the experience of buying and assembling a piece of IKEA furniture, right? At least once. Yeah. So what is this? Like if you look, let's put on the knowledge-centric lens, okay? And look at this thing, like assembling a piece of IKEA furniture, right? So what you do, you have some material things, like the parts of the furniture. You have some screws, probably, and some other things that actually will stick the pieces together. And also you have a very small piece of paper, which is supposed to tell you how to do this thing, right? And if you look at this, like the small piece of paper, the manual actually, it looks like very easy, right? You just have to screw, to tighten a few screws, maybe 10 or something like that. Usually it's not that much, right? Because I do have experience with things like that. And then actually for me, last time I did it, it took me 2.5 hours. And I was very, very frustrated. Because why? Because I didn't know what to do. I mean, I had a very brief description, but many, many details, they were not in the description. For instance, should I sit on a chair while doing this work or be like straight, right? How should I approach the thing, the instruments that I need? How should I, you know, plenty, plenty of questions. So if you look at this thing, it can be considered for a newbie, for a rookie furniture assembler like me, it is a knowledge intensive exercise. It's not that much physically intensive exercise. It was for me, at least, it is a knowledge extensive. A lot of knowledge actually I miss and I need to find it out. So this is so if you put this lens, many things in the world will look a bit different. Yeah. At least I believe so.
What do you think this perspective is missing to such a large extent? At least that's what we're saying here.
So here, maybe I should... So it has two sides of this thing. Why should we look at... Why should we put the lens of this knowledge-centric perspective? And let me share a story with you about this. So a few years ago... I held the role of a CTO at a software development firm. And one day, an opportunity knocked on our door. The local branch of the largest global insurance company wanted our services. And their goal was to initiate a digital transformation that would streamline the process of selling insurance digitally. And so they proposed a test if we were able to do in 20 business days a solution for one of their retail products. We will be their go-to for the rest of the project. And I had some issues with this internal. First of all, the corporate IT from the insurance giant had a mandate that we use their proprietary Java-based object-oriented library, a very big library of more than 300 classes, interfaces, and workflows. And it was a good idea in general, like to use it, but we didn't have on our bench people with such a large object-oriented experience. So I recognized the opportunity and the complexity of the Java library, and I had a decision to make. So among our junior developers, there was one, the name was Martin, and I believed he had great potential, right? So I decided to delve into this library myself, train Martin along the way, and at the end of the project, the idea was Martin to be kind of the nucleus and the source of knowledge about this library, right? And a long story short, we executed the plan. Martin very fast got the idea about the library and the whole thing about classes and interfaces, and we delivered the project on time, the solution on time, and this achievement secured us the contract for the larger digital transformation. But the efficiency with which Martin acquired this new knowledge was really impressive, and actually I was able to quantify it back then. I was playing with what would have become Cadillac, like with this, the measuring tool. And I tracked the progress. And the progress was impressive, both on individual and on the team level, especially for Martin. And this experience undermines the essential truth that with targeted training and tasks that align with their capabilities, even junior developers can perform at levels comparable to seasoned professionals. So it's not about years of experience, it's about the conditions that we put people into. But this ideal scenario where capabilities match the challenge of the work is still kind of eluding in our industry. And this leads to a lot of untapped, unexploited human potential in the industry. And as Deming rightfully stated, and by the way, I am Deming's publisher in Bulgaria, so I very much like him. So he said that the greatest waste is the failure to use the ability of people. And currently, I believe that that's the case in our industry. We very much underutilize our human potential. But it's not only... So this is one side of the problem with missing knowledge when we put the knowledge-centric lens on. The other side is that the misalignment between one's skills and capabilities and the tasks they need to perform, actually, this misalignment leads to a dissonance between the data flow, and actually leads to a very bad developer experience and affects people's well-being. So there are two sides of the same, let's say, problem. Yeah, so this one is, let's say, organizational side, and the other is personal side. So that's why this perspective actually shows us, at least to many of us, that first of all, we have a lot of untapped potential in the industry. And second of all, the people in the industry are not happy because of the experience they have at work, which actually affects their well-being. So this is the importance of having this knowledge-centric perspective.
Mm. That's a... I don't know if it's the correct word here, but it's a very deep and I don't know, somehow a very humane way to look at the state of the industry, and that's very refreshing, I would say.
Yeah, it is humane, but at the same time, it is it can be packaged as an economic problem, right? If you go to a C-level executive, you probably would not emphasize on the human side of the thing, right? You might emphasize on the untapped potential and say, well, the company is paying people and they do, and their potential is underutilized. Okay, so this is valid, right? So if the company, the organization starts looking into this, they will also affect the human side of the problem, right? Even kind of unintentionally. Even though many companies, they actually take actions in order to improve developer experience and from that harness their untapped potential, right? So, for instance, they offer training. The whole thing about agile and lean practices, it is more or less about learning, right, all the time. They offer mentorship programs, continuous feedback, 360 feedback, you know. So there are interventions and actions in this regard. But the thing is that, you know, it stays kind of as you pointed out, kind of a qualitative level, right? Because you cannot actually say, what is a potential? How can you measure it, right? I mean, the potential is very intangible thing, right? And then developer experience, how you can actually measure developer experience, right? So this is all more or less like companies, they spend money on all these initiatives, But at the end, they are not able to actually measure the impact. Yeah. So this is a kind of a gap in the industry in general.
Mm. And I guess that boils down to the fact that it's typically very difficult to quantify these things that are intangible, like you said, that it makes it very difficult for people to handle them and manage them.
Yes,
and they
yes.
resort to more like these easier things that are more physical or material or easier to
exactly.
see or things like that.
Yeah, because what the saying is this: you measure what you can measure, right? So if you assume that first of all, human potential as such, this notion of human potential is immeasurable, nobody would try measuring. Although, well, there are people, let's say, use surveys. So they survey their developers. And I believe at Google, that's what they do. At least the last thing that I heard from there. So they actually ask developers, how good are you? I don't know the exact questions, but in general, what's your developer experience and how it affects your productivity, whatever productivity means, right? So they do try. But again, this is, a survey, you cannot... it can be quantified. There are mathematical models, but it's not the real thing because, let's say, what everybody has their different perspective on well-being, what actually means to have a good developer experience. Because some people might think that having a good developer experience should be accompanied with a very challenging work on a daily basis. Other people might say, well, I prefer more routine work. And that's, it stays at a very qualitative level. And then you go to, let's say, a C-level executive to people who actually manage the money and they have the responsibility for the whole organization. And when you present them with this, I would put it like fluffy thing, right? And then probably they will not consider it at all, right? Why? Because they are trained to look at numbers. It's something that can compare. Let's say you can compare profit between company A and company B. You can compare expenses between company A and company B. But you cannot compare using surveys, developer experience, the level, whatever it is, between company A or company B. So that's my take on tank. And as you said, people, when they decide that, it cannot be measured, they just forget about it. Like, for instance, let's a very kind of sensitive for males example. If people assume that there is no cure for baldness, they don't try to find it, right? Because obviously it's impossible to find it. Like, or a more mathematical kind of an example, the last theorem of Fermat, and it was proved several years ago. And after the proof, and people waited for the proof for 300 years, right? And after the proof, several alternative proofs actually emerged, which means that when people know that something is possible, they would invest time and effort into this. If we know that something is impossible, why bother?
About this fluffiness and talking to the senior management and people who have the responsibility for the well-being of the entire organization, what are, like, I don't know, let's say the top three primary reasons why they should care about these fluffy things?
So first of all, getting back to the two sides of the same problem, right? First of all, they pay. So if we are talking about executives and managers, money managers, and people who actually are responsible for an organization, they pay money for human potential, and they expect this money to be return, that there should be some return on investment, right? So and right now, they really don't. They cannot connect developer experience with economic productivity. They cannot say, well, we would invest $100,000 into improving developer experience, and we expect productivity to to improve by 10%. It's not possible to say like with just having a survey, right? Because after the survey, the developers might say, well, my developer experience improved. And how much it improved, I don't know, because you cannot measure it like in percentage or something. You can, but it's very difficult. And this actually has effect on the well-being of the C-level executives as well, right? Because they cannot actually manage the most important capital they have, their human capital. That's the most important asset they have. And they spend a lot of money in our industry in order to attract top talent, right? A lot of money. And they cannot connect develop experience with economic productivity. And then when we go down on the corporate ladder, engineering managers from the CTO to team leads, they don't have the tangible and objective data points in order to validate their effective management practices, which means that if they claim under their stewardship, let's say a team got happier and more productive from that, there is no data to prove this, which actually affects the engineering managers as human beings. Again, it would affect their career trajectory, their well-being, their standing in the organization, and everything around this. So this is another party, and let's say human resource professionals. So they arrange trainings and they are responsible for cultivating the talent of the company. But again, whatever they do, they cannot measure it. Then they cannot objectively say what was the effect of the latest training or whatever they do around cultivating talent. So their practices are questioned again. So what, from my perspective, like if we put this knowledge-centric lens, we see that the input, the greatest and the most expensive input in software development industry, it was impossible to be measured, right? So people are walking more or less blind about this. But then we talk about developers, right? And they have this like everything is on their back, let's put it this way, because developer experience affects also their well-being. And they are kind of on the receiving end of this oversight of what actually is going on with your potential, with your experience, how you feel and everything else. And they are more or less not happy about it. Like if you ask an average developer, they would probably not say that their work experience is as good as it gets, right? So that's the idea. And the end result for the whole company is that those lagging in optimizing developer experience will struggle with slower product delivery, high turnover, and eventually their reputation will repel top talent. And that's why organizations try to do actions around improving developer experience. So there is a human side, both at the C-level and from the whole organization actually is affected by this. That's my understanding.
When you talk to different organizations about these aspects, do you often run into like obstacles or some sort of skepticism that keeps repeating when people react to what you are saying? Are there any common denominators there?
Yes. So let's put it this way. Because it's a new perspective, this knowledge-centric perspective, it's a very hard sell. Because people, they are accustomed that intangible things, they cannot be measured. So it just like, it is what it is, Okay, and this is a valid skepticism, right? We have to accept this. This is valid, right? Because for thousands of years, it was not possible to do this. And that's why people never actually applied this knowledge-centric perspective. But that was the case, for instance, with the thermometer. So the thermometer during, let's say, the Roman Empire, there was no thermometer. There was no concept of temperature at all. There was it is hot today, yesterday was hotter, or, qualitative things, right? And then and people live their lives quite well, probably. But so it is the same thing with every new concept and every new perspective and every new approach. There is a valid skepticism. But the thing is, in our industry, most of the people, they are kind of unaware that there are ways. Because I discuss with many people on a daily basis, trying to actually to see the reaction and everything around this. So many people actually accept it. It's not that they say it's... Very few would say... I had this conversation that it's in lines of... I am not interested in intangible things. I am a software developer engineer. I am an engineer. That's why I'm interested only in tangible things, period. So that's it. There are cases like that. But most of the people, especially people who are interested in improving their lives and the lives of, let's say, if they are managers, the lives of their colleagues, they actually take it on board quite easily. Because it's liberating. You think about it, it is liberating. Let's just use an example, okay? Scrum. And let's put the knowledge-centric perspective lens on our ears and look at what Scrum is. So if I like it, you can have this manufacturing view on Scrum, right? And the manufacturing view would be what it is. Like you have a backlog, and in the backlog there are some requirements or user stories. We have user stories, and we have a process that will take from the backlog these tangible things, and that will be the input to the process, and the output will be a working software, right? Do you agree? This is very simplistic, but more or less.
Yep.
Yeah. So this is the manufacturing perspective on this, and many teams are. When they start applying Scrum, and by the way, I'm a Kanban guy, remember? So I'm not against Scrum or anything like that. I'm a very pragmatic in this regard. So this is the manufacturing perspective. So they optimize this manufacturing, let's say, process, okay? But then in Scrum, there is this notion of the sprint goal, right? And this sprint goal, if you look at it, what is actually the sprint goal? It is indeed to deliver working software, right? But if you look from knowledge-centric perspective and take a bit deeper dive into the concept, the theory of the flow state, championed by the American by the name Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, a very difficult name. He's from Hungarian descent, I believe. And it says that in order for a human being to be in the state of flow, and by the way, let's say to our listeners what actually is a state of flow. So a state of flow is a state of optimal feeling and experience at the same time, maximum productivity of whatever a person is doing. And this state is achieved according to the positive psychology when there is a balance between individual capabilities and the work complexity with a slight inclination towards challenges, which means that the work in front of a human should be challenging enough, but not too much. Okay. And this is again very qualitative. Okay. Now, if we and how actually one gets into this state, and there is a very well taught and described and presented in the positive psychology mechanism to do this, and it actually what it says is that you need to create a flow loop. That's how they call it, flow loop, but it's not the flow of tangible things. It's like the loop for getting into the state of achieving the state flow. And first up, and there are three components about this loop. So first of all is like you have to have an opportunity for action. And this means you have to have, a person has to have a clear proximal goal. And now getting back to a Scrum, and there is this thing, sprint goal, right? And it is working software, but if we look from a knowledge-centric perspective, it should be a clear and proximal goal. That's, I believe, the exact wording in the Scrum manifesto, or at least very similar to this, right? So what one needs in order to, so this goal is not just like a slogan or something like that. It has three components, again, according to the positive psychology. The first component is the person, the human needs to know what to do. The second component is the human needs to know how to do the what, how to actually to achieve this what. And the third component is to know where to go next. So assuming the goal is achieved, what is the next step? Or if the goal is comprises of several steps, so what is like step by step? And then if there is such a goal, the second component of the flow loop is to have action. And action actually means that there should be a balance between the capabilities of what we actually have as skills and expertise and knowledge and the goal. And the goal comprises of what to do, how to do it, and where to go next. So these are two kind of knowledge levels, right? Our current knowledge level and the required knowledge for achieving the goal. And then the third component, again, from a positive psychology, and it is well before Scrum. I believe the first publication on the topic was in 1975 or something like that. So the third component is to have a very fast performance feedback. So at any point in time, the human needs to know, are they actually getting closer to the goal or not? And if we look from this perspective at Scrum and we forget about, or at least add a complementary perspective, the knowledge-centric perspective, what would actually we would look at? So first of all, we have a sprint goal. And hopefully there is something like described, like definition of done and everything, definition of ready, like what needs to be done, how to do it, right? And then we have the current, and this is a required knowledge level. And then we have in our team the current knowledge, the existing knowledge level, right? And we have to do a kind of calculation in our assessment, in our mind, about what is the difference between the existing knowledge level and the required knowledge level. And this, again, taking there must be a balance in order for the individual developers in the team and the team as such on average to be in the state of flow. There must be a balance between the required knowledge and existing knowledge. And if there is like quite a big disbalance, the team, according to the Scrum guide, at least from what I can recall, they might say that the goal is not achievable. No, it is possible, according to Scrum, the team to say, no, this is, we don't accept this goal, right? You know, do you agree? Like, I believe you have experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They can reject, theoretically. In practice, I don't. But
maybe not
they
so
can
much.
Reject. So, yeah, but, I mean, they can. So if you look from a knowledge-centric perspective, Scrum actually is an ambitious mechanism for getting into the state of flow on individual level and on the team level. And the idea, the assumption is after that there will be productivity after that, right? Because people, when they know what to do and how to do it, and their existing knowledge is in balance with the required knowledge, they will achieve their goal and it will be manifested into some working software.
These things we've been discussing, they are fairly difficult things to sort of find practical ways of actually getting into and start improving and measuring and all that stuff. So how do we move on from the like the abstract level of talking about these things into the real world and actually improving these aspects?
Yeah. So first, again, getting back to the example with Scrum, looked at from a knowledge-centric viewpoint, this is very practical. I, from my experience as a manager, like managing software development initiatives, this is very practical on a practical level. And then, again, in order for us as managers and like professionals, in order to be able to objectively validate our effective practices, assuming that Scrum is effective, okay? And I believe Scrum is effective practice. We need to objectively validate this, which means putting some numbers. And here is what I'm involved with for the past few years, is that we develop a mathematical model, a peer-reviewed model, that allows us to assess this intangible, the missing knowledge, the missing information, the difference between existing knowledge and required knowledge, or in other words, the gap between capabilities and work complexity. And this mathematical model is exemplified, manifested by a quantity called knowledge discovery efficiency. And this quantity, it is a mathematical theorem, actually, again, peer-reviewed. And it is it tries to see, to quantify this gap between existing knowledge and required knowledge, this knowledge gap. And this quantity, based on this quantity, we have several measures that are in addition. So, for instance, collaboration level, cognitive load, happiness in terms of flow state, and rework, but not in terms of lines of code or something like physical, but in terms of information loss rate. And this mathematical apparatus is available. One cannot patent a mathematical formula or like have kind of a copyright. So it is available there. And on top of that, we like what I'm involved in is like we have a tool that implements this mathematical model in practice for software developers. It's called CADEHUB. And it is it's the tool that implements the mathematical model. In theory, there might be other tools implementing the same implementing the same mathematical models. But at present, there is only one tool. And for this tool, the technology is patented. We have United States patent on it. But this is for the technology, not for the idea. So the idea is open. Everybody can actually see it. Although the patent is also open. Anybody can actually look at it and literally like following the steps, they can implement their own copy of CADEHUB or something like that. There is the difference. I want to put the difference. There is one thing is the knowledge-centric perspective, the way we look and probably should look at the world around us, and the mathematical model that quantifies this knowledge-centric perspective. That's one thing. And then the tool that I'm involved with is like implementing how actually in practice using software this can be done. Yeah.
If there's one thing the listeners should take with them from out of this discussion, what should it be?
So, since software is such, is eating the world. Yeah, there was such saying by, I believe, Ben Horowitz, right? Software is eating the world. Whatever we do in our industry affects more or less the whole world. And with the leaps into AI development, it will be affecting the world more and more and more and more into the coming near future. Yeah. Which means that we as an industry, we have kind of a responsibility. And it is to make software as cheap as possible so that not only the wealthy nations and people can use generative AI, but more or less everybody, which means, first of all, software should be cheaper or produced faster, right? This is the economic side of the thing. And we have, at least for me, we have this obligation to the world. We are responsible for this. On the other hand, we have to think about the people involved in producing this software. And at present, their well-being is not at par. It's not where it should be, right? So first of all, and this is because their potential is not utilized. So yesterday I had a conversation with a senior developer, and it was not like the first time when I heard that the problem in our industry is the management. And it's not that the managers are not honest and good people, most of them are. It is because the way it is managed is not the proper way. And everybody feels that it's not the proper way. It is managed like a manufacturing facility, and it is not the proper way. And from that, we leave a lot of human potential on the table. And from that, the software is not getting cheap. Actually, it's getting more and more expensive, like looking at the salaries, right? It's getting more and more expensive. At the same time, the people involved, they are not getting happier. They are anxious. They are under stress because of this difference between their capabilities and the challenges they face. And this is the role of the management, first of all, to actually, let's assume that indeed in an organization producing software, there is certain potential, okay? Let's assume there is a potential. And then we are obliged to utilize this potential, right? Because if we don't, it will be there, left on the table. Software will be expensive, and people, which actually are the potential, right? They will be unhappy because they work on stuff which is not, they cannot get into the state of flow during their work because of the way it is organized. So it is the management responsibility, first of all, to assess what is the level on a daily operational level, like on a daily basis, what is the level between the gap between capabilities of the team or individuals and the work complexity, and then manage it accordingly. And like by providing training, mentorship, and agile and everything, right? So this is, and then when they, and hopefully they will start measuring it, right? And after that, when they manage it in the proper direction, people will get happier, developers will get closer to the flow state. From that, their potential will be more utilized from a productivity perspective, economic perspective. And from that, software at least will not get more expensive. At least will stay at this level, hopefully. Maybe get cheaper. And from that, the world will get better. That's my.
All right, perfect. That paints a very beautiful future for the industry, Dimitar. So I really hope we can get there sooner rather than later.
We have to.
Yeah, exactly. So before we end, if someone in the audience is curious about learning more about these things and how this new kind of perspective might help, how would they go about doing that? Is there somewhere they can get in touch with you, or
Oh yes, they can find me on LinkedIn, Dimitar, and they can Google for, let's say, KEDE Hub, KEDEHUB. So they yep. will be like we have more than 150,000 words of documentation around KEDE Hub. It's a very, very small part of it is about, it's actually product documentation. Most of it is how to apply and practice this knowledge-centric perspective. Yeah, and I'm open for any kind of new connections and everything. And thank you, Yusuf, for this talk. Hopefully it was not too long. I tend to talk.
No. We're not doing any Joe Rogans here, but long format is perfect. And I'll post the links to all these things that you mentioned in the notes and everywhere, so people yeah. can find them easy. All right, perfect. Thank you for taking the time. That's it, folks, for this time. I hope you found that interesting and worthy of your time. If you like this sort of stuff, why not subscribe to the podcast? Episodes will be published rather irregularly, but I hope quantity doesn't necessarily rule over quality here. I would appreciate any sort of feedback on the episode and the podcast in general, so feel free to send me some feedback on scrapingtoasts.com or on social media. Until next time, take it easy.